You need to know so you can plan your carbon emissions and budget for your new tax bill, you one percenters. And so you can book that nonstop from SeaTac to Havana. Who's coming with me?
Oh, yeah.
Coming with me to Cuba.
I am.
Joni Balter, you're coming?
Oh, yeah.
Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Deb Wong, you're with me?
Totally.
KUOW reporter Deborah Wong. Cairo 7 reporter Essex Porter, you seem noncommittal. You don't want to travel with us?
I check my miles first.
You have plenty of time to pack. Don't worry. Those flights are not coming anytime real soon. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. We are going to cover the week's news. We're going to go underground with Bertha and did North Korea attack the United States and how do we respond to that? But first, our top story this week in Washington State, and you just heard about it in sort of condensed form from Austin Jenkins, is Governor Inslee and his taxing and spending and liberaling. Wow. First of all, did Governor Inslee break a pledge that he made in his campaign for governor? Because here he is on the campaign trail in 2012.
Read my lips.
I was unable to find the Jay Inslee tape, but...
Sounds just like him, just even though it's not.
Swap that out.
And did the exact same thing happen?
Yes. There you go. Did he make a no new taxes pledge that he just broke this week?
You have to... Always depends on the definition. He seemed very definitive on no new taxes. He also pledged to get the money in part from a growing economy and from closing tax loopholes, of which there are more than 600 in Washington State. Wasn't able to close many tax loopholes, so that's how he explains going back on his pledge to propose tax increases.
And we've got these new mandates for education. The state has to do something this year to fully fund education.
But we knew about that when he was running for governor, right?
Well, it's sort of coming to a head this year.
The Supreme Court wasn't threatening him with jail back then.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But, in fact, he does have to reconcile with what he said during the election, and that will come up quickly enough for him. But meanwhile, he looks like he's just having a jolly time here with, as he said, let the polluters pay for government.
Yes.
You know, not you folks, although they frequently pass some of those costs on. And then for the other tax that he's discussing,
capital gains,
This is very calculated. Folks in Washington State have never supported a state income tax for the simple reason that they think it'll be plus to the sales tax. But don't forget that they have supported the estate tax. And so it's not that they're saying they mind taxing wealthy people. It's they mind taxing middle class people.
Hmm. So who would pay the capital gains tax, Essex?
And to pick up on Joni's point, this is very carefully designed to exclude taxing middle-class people. The governor says it'll really only be 1% of Washingtonians who would end up being taxed here. If you're a couple, the first $50,000 in a capital gain that's eligible is still free.
You sell your stocks, your bonds.
Yeah, the first $50,000 still tax-free. Okay. Only above that is that capital gain taxed. Your home, the capital gain on your home is not taxed. The capital gain on your farm is not taxed.
Okay, so we'll get into the politics of this too, of course. But let's also say a little bit more about this carbon charge. We don't want to raise the gas tax. It's bringing in less money anyway. We're driving less. We're buying hybrids, etc. So Governor Inslee proposed that we charge, as Joni said, the major polluters for the right to emit carbon.
So rather than raising a gas tax on anyone and everyone, our worst polluters will step up and pay instead. Big transportation polluters, which includes the oil and gas industry, will pay a charge for every ton of pollution they put into the skies of the state of Washington.
A charge, not a tax.
Yeah, that's an important word distinction there. He definitely needs that. And you've seen the list, have you not, of the top polluters. And so the way this works,
oil refiners.
Yeah, and the coal plant and some of the other industries. But the way this works is the way somebody explained this to me is that, you know, so the companies that will have an easier time reducing pollution will be the ones that'll do it, the so-called low-hanging fruit, That's what will happen first. And then there will be all that swapping, cap and trade, right? Trade.
Right. We can't stop polluting, so we're going to buy the right to do that.
Right. But as you know, every year as this goes forward, if it's ever adopted, you lower the total cap on emissions so that you're meeting, you know, ever cleaner standards, right?
Mm-hmm. And presumably it gives companies incentives to pollute less, to lower their carbon emissions because they have to pay. I mean, it becomes a financial incentive for them to be much more efficient and to pollute less.
Is this why Boeing said this week they happen to say they're switching to all renewable energy at the 737 factory, or that's unrelated?
I think they are related. I don't know if they're, you know, precisely connected because, of course, there has to be a lot of planning in advance to do that.
Right.
But, you know, there's nothing that prevents businesses from being more efficient now. Do they really need government prodding? And I think that's one of the things Boeing has done in saying, you know, we make a little bigger profit if we spend a little less on energy.
One of the things I wonder is, though, I mean, this is something that people who are involved in climate change, progressives, Democrats have been pushing for years and wondering why he's taken so long to get this done, right? But, I mean, you guys might know better. How is this going to play in the legislature? We have, Doug Erickson, who's the senator, chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, basically calls this a tax on freedom.
In fact, let's hear Doug Erickson in full. He happens to be from the Ferndale area, home to those oil refineries. What do you think, Senator?
People understand that putting a tax on energy is a tax that's going to drive up the price of a gallon of gasoline. It's going to drive up the cost of heating people's homes. So I think the people are smart enough to understand what he's actually saying. No matter how you try to phrase it, it's a tax on energy, and that's a tax on freedom, and that's a tax on working people.
A tax on energy is a tax on freedom. Is this going anywhere in the legislature?
Well, it's going to have a hard time in the legislature, would be one way to put it, because there is a Republican-controlled Senate. But what, in some ways, Jay Inslee might be doing is saying, okay, and this is risky for him because it is in contrast to what he said during the election, but he is saying, this is my plan. I have money to fund the many things that were either under court order or that we want to pay for. If you don't like my plan, what do you have? What's on your agenda?
What are they going to say?
The thing you have to understand is Governor Inslee, as a congressman, had and continues to have a really, really deep personal commitment to the carbon-free economy. And so this is his opportunity to do something that he's so deeply committed to anyway and has been for years. The last time I asked him about it, he said he was willing to risk lots of political capital on this. Even, you know, if it fails, certainly everyone knows where he is and knows what not to like about him. So it's going to have repercussions when it comes time for re-election.
How does this process work in the legislature, though? Because it's not the governor's. It's not like in the city of Seattle where the governor proposes. I'm sorry, the Senate, the mayor proposes a budget, and the city council basically adopts the framework of the mayor's budget. What does the governor's budget mean in Olympia?
Well, the governor's budget lands, and it's this precious little document that sits there, and then the House and the Senate also come up
with their own versions.
With their own versions, and they look. The House budget writer, Ross Hunter, was at the press conference, so he looks to me like he's a little bit on board on the carbon tax. He hasn't really shown his hand exactly on that, but you can tell some of that's going to be in the House budget. But then they thrash back and forth, and pretty soon it's July 4th. Just kidding. And, and they have to come up with some kind of a compromise. The governor, if he really cares, and I agree with you, Essex, he really wants to be known as the climate change governor, really, really wants that. So then if he wants to get actively involved, he goes in and goes back and forth to the two groups and gives us the final document.
Okay, let's give, we're going to move on to Bertha here. Something about Bertha needs to move. And I'll give the last word to Governor Jay Inslee from earlier in the campaign, 2011, when he talked to our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins.
I can imagine scenarios where I could go to reduce tax revenues, and I could imagine scenarios where I would go where I would ask the voters to increase revenues. It depends on the circumstances involved. I've been willing to do that.
Aha! He was on the record. Maybe he said them both.
He's for everything. What are you going to do?
For everything. That's going to be fascinating. So we'll keep following that, of course.
You're going to have to ask the voters if tax revenues pass, the voters will be putting this on the ballot in some way, and they'll be voting on it one way or the other.
On the ballot. I asked you to sum up 2014 in one word. I asked our listeners this, and Jer said her word is frost, which is something that the youngsters are saying, probably our Bon Huberman, you know, our social media producer. I'd never heard it before. It means to give up. And she says it goes for a bunch of very Seattle businesses that disappeared this year. Paseo, Picora's Pizza, Harvard Exit, El Puerco Yaron, Louis Cuisine of China, and more. She said it could also go for Bertha. Here's the what's going on with this tunnel project. It's getting... Well, you tell me what it's getting. The deal is the viaduct is dangerous. Bertha is supposed to make a tunnel. Digging Bertha out of the ground is making the ground sink, which is making the viaduct dangerous. Okay, so we're in a bit of a trap here. Everybody's arguing over who pays, and I'm hearing more, should we just skip the tunnel, crush the viaduct, and make it a nice surface street? Is this just blogger hysteria, or is... Is the ground shifting like Pioneer Square here? Is there a chance this project is a fail?
There is a chance for that, but let's talk about the number one goal here. The number one goal is not to turn Pioneer Square into one giant underground tour, right?
No.
So as you do that, as you build this, what you're trying to do is keep things steady. And so there have been so many setbacks, and that's what's riling the bloggers and the original critics.
Mm-hmm.
And fair enough on that. Now, the digging of the pit to rescue the front of Bertha, the 57.5-foot diameter Bertha, has resumed. But there were some scares this week. There were cracks at First and King, if that's the right intersection, which was quickly paved over, I might add. And there was some worry about settlement, apparently another inch or more of settlement and some cracks in buildings. So far what folks are saying is those cracks are cosmetic, but there is a water main under there that is a 100-year-old water main. So what we don't know, so the settling probably led to that being at risk. But, you know, you might want to ask the question, has the city been trying to repair that and throwing that over?
Yeah, you have to. I mean,
you know, but 100 years for a water main is nothing. Water mains are supposed to last a really long time. 100 years for a water main is, you know, just a little bit past the teenage years. If this settling is bending it and making it so that it needs to be repaired, they had to lower the water pressure in the main. So, I mean, there's something significant there.
Well, KOW's Joshua McNichols took us to a newspaper office in Pioneer Square this week where the door has always been a little sticky.
But after workers started pumping out water to rescue the stuck drill, the door got worse.
A couple of months ago, we had to take it off the hinges in order to get it out of the door jamb. It was completely stuck.
A coworker asked Lampy if the tunnel project was the reason the door got stuck. We're saying it is now, he answered.
I put two and two together, so it makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. We're saying it is now. The state transportation secretary, Lynn Peterson, sees this ditch as half full, more than half.
While the vast majority of the replacement of the viaduct is complete, in fact, 70%, is done and on the ground.
Viaduct replacement is 70% complete. The tunneling has stopped like a tenth of the way through. No completion date. As the stranger said, that's like saying the Donner Party's trip to California was 70% complete.
It's kind of funny math, isn't it? You know, they were parsing it that 70% in ways that maybe the average person wouldn't parse it.
Yes.
It doesn't look like the tunnel is complete. There's a lot of other associated projects that
there's a lot of above ground work.
Right. I think
the
general point that was being made is that work is not stopped on the tunnel project. There are other things that are still going on in anticipation of Bertha eventually being repaired and the actual tunnel being bored. But, you know, the question is, even if they get the pit built, the rescue pit built, and if they take the front end off Bertha and fix it, is that going to be it?
We don't know.
I mean, did we get a lemon? I mean, there's so many questions that have still to be yet to be answered.
Will Bertha restart and go a little bit farther under some building where we really can't get to her?
I think that we should expect, you know, more problems, but also we should expect that the way that we react to this is we're sort of fickle. If Bertha's moving, we don't even want to talk about it.
Right.
If Bertha is stuck, oh my gosh, Bertha shall be the joke.
The sky is falling on everyone except Bertha.
Right.
Because she's stuck underground.
Resting comfortably underground, yeah. As I understand.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean.
Work.
It's like it's emotional. Like when I'm bopping around, I'm reading about this, and I just keep seeing more of these. I mean, the New York Times is reporting this. NPR is reporting on this. You know, much less like the environmental site Grist it called it a fuster cluck. A Seattle's unbelievable.
I'm really impressed that you tried that word
thank
in
you.
The air.
Thank you.
Because that might have not gotten so well.
I'm just saying, like. I don't know. I just wonder if anyone else is starting to shake a little bit.
There's a lot at stake in this project. There's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of people's probably professional reputations at stake. We have a viaduct that's probably going to fall down one of these days if we don't do something about it. I mean, the arguing and the debates that went on in the years leading up to this. I mean,
yes.
This was years and years and years of fighting to get to this point. And somehow something has to happen. You know, something has to get done. If the thing just fails and they can't finish it, I mean, what a disaster that would be.
And this could sound very overheated, right? Next, when we're talking next year, we just don't know. I mean, maybe it was like, wow, we were really. We were nervous Nellies there, and they started the machine. Everything's fine. But right in the middle of it, you don't know.
One thing I keep trying to remember is, you know, there's a tunnel underneath the English Channel.
Right.
It's not like there can't be tunnels.
Right, right. They studied this.
Well, and that's a good point, because the companies that are doing this, this is their livelihood.
Yes.
If they don't finish this, this is their worldwide reputation or lack of reputation.
But don't forget, the reason that this was considered cutting edge, so to speak, was that this was the largest tunnel boring machine ever, right? So we were pushing the envelope to begin with. And
yeah,
the whole
absolutely.
Reason we decided to do it this way was because it was cheaper than boring two separate tunnels for each direction of traffic. You put one big tunnel down there, you can stack the traffic in two directions, it would be cheaper, and we could do it within budget. So there was some risk involved at the very beginning. We had never seen a tunnel this wide being bored before.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah. And this isn't even the weirdest story of all those poor people compiling their years in review. we're doing this right before the cyber attack, cyber terrorism. We're going to get into that in just a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke with Essex Porter of Cairo TV, Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Bloomberg View contributor. Deborah Wong is a reporter for KUOW and host of In Close on KCTS 9. And if you could spend your Christmas day any way you wanted, would you go see a movie about blowing up Kim Jong-un's head?
Absolutely not. That's what's so funny about this. It sounded like a fairly awful movie, but there is a principle here.
There's a principle.
There's a
and
principle
more.
Here about giving in to that.
As everyone knows, somebody hacked Sony Pictures Entertainment, released the emails and movies and personal records, and the hackers demanded that Sony cancel its release of this Seth Rogen comedy, The Interview, about a plan, CIA plan to assassinate North Korea's leader. And Sony did that. And this was under threat of, like, we're going to blow people up and kill people. It's going to be 9/11 style. Sony pulled the plug on the movie. Today, the FBI officially accused the North Korean government of organizing this attack. This is the first time the U.S. has accused the leaders of a foreign nation of sending destructive computer code to strike on American soil. It started as a joke, this story, and now we have accused an enemy of the U.S. that has nuclear weapons of sort of attacking us. Is it cyber terrorism, as some people call it, or is that just Republicans trying to goad President Obama into?
Well, the first thing is, if this is a free speech issue, you know, no one's preventing Sony from speaking here. They could put the movie online for free right now and have all the free speech they want.
Why don't they do that?
Well, presumably because they've been threatened. I mean,
right.
I imagine that they think that if they do that, worse things will happen to them than the leaking of emails. I mean, I'm not sure what that would be, but you know, that the North Koreans have more up their sleeves.
That is a possible next step, however, to just say we're not going to bother with the theaters, although this, again, that First Amendment problem they have. We're not going to bother with the theaters. We'll just put it online. And if you're sitting there watching it, I don't think the North Koreans would know that you were watching it, but you never know.
And George Clooney came out and said, I gave a letter to all the other studio heads and not as, to say, we stand united. We're not going to capitulate to this garbage, and not a single studio signed it. He says, in part because everybody's scared, of course, of the threats, but also of what they've said in emails that they don't want the world to see. And you have to wonder, why is this just Sony? How vulnerable is the New York Times to, you know, are they not covering North Korea critically because the same thing could happen? And obviously, how vulnerable are, you know, is the government and major infrastructure companies and on and on and on? It's really, we don't know where we are in this.
I wonder if there's this sort of principle of mutual assured destruction going on, because, I mean, presumably, we know that a lot of people have the capability of hacking into institutions, probably into governments. There's a lot of people out there that could do serious damage to all of us. But whether as governments, whether they're kind of, you know, holding their ammunition, keeping their powder dry because they know that the same thing can happen to them. I don't know. I just feel like it is incredibly scary when you think about what could go wrong for all of us.
Well, the slippery slope is the issue here. I mean, I don't know how many people are specifically crying over the fact that they might miss the interview. It is the slippery slope that's the problem. What's next?
You know, this point about George Clooney has, that the rest of Hollywood would not stand up with Sony. You know, if the rest of Hollywood doesn't stand up with Sony, I'm not so sure the United States government should then be putting resources and perhaps going to war with North Korea for something the rest of Hollywood is not even standing up for.
Right. You know what? I got to pause and just tell you that nothing stops the Week in Review. Not a threat, okay? not a hack. But President Obama is going to be speaking here in just, you know, a minute or so. And believe me, he'll be talking about North Korea. This is his year-end news conference. Mm-hmm. He'll talk Cuba. He'll talk torture.
What's the first question going to be? Is it going to be about Cuba, which is totally historic? Or is it going to be about the interview movie, a comedy about assassination to be released on Christmas Day? What's the first question from the Beltway media today?
First question is, how do you respond to North Korea? The FBI has accused North Korea of an attack. How do you respond? Right? Well, we're all going to find out, because President Obama is going to speak. We're bringing it to you live. And this show will continue online and on podcast. So tune in online and podcast us. Hang on. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. After hours. We're only online now.
We can say anything.
Because the president is on the radio and we're at the grown-up table. Hi, everybody. Deborah Wong, KUOW reporter, Essex Porter of Cairo TV. Joni Balter, Seattle Channel. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
If you grew up in the Pacific Northwest, you don't talk like other people. Just ask this University of Washington sociolinguistics professor.
I had a student from Rhode Island, and he said that when he came to campus, one of the first things that he remembers is being invited to a party, and he baked a cake and took it to this party, and when he got there, he was shocked to discover that he had brought entirely the wrong thing to the party. He thought that he was being invited to a cake party, C-A-K-E, and he was being invited to a keg party.
That's keg, K-E-G as in beer, not cake as in yummy. Do we have our own accent out here? KUOW reporter Deborah Wong, you did that story this week.
Yeah, it was really fun. And so there's long been this idea that people in the western half of the United States don't really have specific accents. And the reason,
except for Jeff Spicoli in L.A.
Oh, I don't.
The surfer dude.
Oh yeah, that guy. Yeah. True. Well, now we do know that there's a California accent. But basically, linguists had never really didn't study the western half of the United States, so they just kind of put it all in one linguistic grab bag. But these folks at the University of Washington have been studying the way we speak, and they did find that we have some unique ways of pronouncing things. You know, keg is one of them. Anything that's ends with a hard G, with an E or an A ending in a hard G, often people raise that vowel.
Flag, bag,
instead of bag.
Yep.
And then there's words that we merge together, like cot, what you sleep in, and caught, like you've caught a fish.
Mm-hmm.
It often sounds the same to Pacific Northwesterners. They just say caught. And so this story, which was really fun to report, somebody posted it on Reddit. And this huge discussion ensued about the word bagel.
Yeah.
We've got Luke Burbank, who is public radio personality. And he and I actually had this conversation about bagel as well. So I want you to listen to that.
I have actually had girlfriends who didn't grow up in the Northwest make fun of how I said bagel, that she thought I said it wrong. So that's as close as I've ever come to being told I have an accent.
Bagel is wrong, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I guess it should be what, bagel?
Bagel.
Bagel. Why would it be bagel?
Let's go over that again, just because it was subtle. Here's how Luke says it.
Bagel.
Here's how all right-thinking people say it.
Bagel.
And here's what Luke heard when Deborah Wong said it correctly.
Bagel. Why would it be bagel?
What?
So Joni, who's Jewish, is about to, like, her head is going to explode right now.
Yeah.
You speak for all Jews on this?
No, Joni? I can't do that. But I can say that Luke is way off on this. There's no debate. It is bagel, and just deal with it, sir.
Where are you from, Joni?
I am from Pittsburgh,
uh-huh.
Which is, this is where people say things like jeet. In other words, did you eat?
Uh-huh.
Or jever. Jever go downtown.
Uh-huh.
Okay, wait a minute. But I also went to my neighbor, Sharon, who's Jewish, and she grew up here. And I wanted to see whether Luke is not Jewish, right?
Uh-huh, that's right.
But I wanted to see how locals who are Jewish said the word. So we got that tape, too.
How do you say the word B-A-G-E-L? Bagel. Bagel. Is that like a bagel A with a long A?
Yes.
Okay. Bagel. Have you always said it bagel?
I've always said it bagel.
So have you heard other people around here say that word differently?
I've heard bagel, but it sounds all wrong to me. It's a bagel.
It's a bagel.
So my contention, if people think this is crazy, but my contention is that Jews everywhere in the world say bagel. And,
wow.
And I'm just throwing that out there because I'm sure there will be people who disagree with me. But I do think this is an ethnic distinction that we have to make.
I'm just going to support the heck out of you, Deborah.
So you brought up the example of caught and caught.
Yes.
And I'm not. I'm from sort of Air Force bases all over. I moved out here in high school. So I completely hear the difference. My parents did. Caught is not the same as caught.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, I don't know if I'm right, but I feel like to say caught and caught are the same thing is wrong.
Right.
So is it wrong or is it an accent or are all accents basically just made up from the fact that everybody's wrong in a different way?
You know, this is a good question.
We're into philosophical territory.
Well, it is philosophical, but there are also things that linguists say about this. On those two particular words, that's called a merger. In other words, people here have taken two vowel sounds and sort of lengthened, smushed them together. What the other thing that the linguist told me is that most Americans have 14 distinct vowel sounds in their vocabulary. We have lost one because we do that merger. So we only have 13. Now, the funny thing about only having 13 vowel sounds is that last vowel sound that you don't say, you also lose the ability to hear it.
Mm.
So there does seem to be something wrong about that. I mean,
which vowel sound did we lose?
The caught.
Oh, that one.
People say it the same way. It's a merger.
Okay.
But bagel, I mean, if you look it up in Merriam-Webster, it's B-A with a long A.
A long A.
And there's even, like, I didn't realize this, if you go online to the dictionary now, you can even push a little button and you can hear some guy saying it, and he says bagel.
But is there something about the hard G? Like, why, how come Northwesterners don't say rain differently, or do they? Or is there something about the hard G, flag, beg? Because I totally hear that. I know we do that.
I think there is something about the hard G, and I the way it was explained to me by these linguists is there is like a tendency in language to raise a vowel before a hard G. It's like a language thing that we do with our mouths.
Mm.
So I guess that means that to say bagel, you have to sort of make an effort.
You have to work
to say
at it.
Because it's not natural.
Other, my question is:
Yes, Essex.
Is there any other?
Where are you from, sir?
I am a Chicago native. My parents did their growing up in Chicago. They're from the South. I'm a military kid, so I lived in Okinawa, Japan, and I lived in Kansas, the Midwest. Went to the University of Nebraska. So my question is this: is there any other reporter at KUOW who could have done this story? Because all the other reporters at KUOW have a discernible accent.
Oh. Where do you think I'm from, Essex?
It is impossible to tell that Deb Wong has any accent at all, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, so this is interesting. I grew up in Chicago, and I sort of say Chicago the same way you do, with a Chicago, right? You can tell, right?
I didn't grow up
you
there.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. And then in the East Coast. But I just find this whole thing fascinating because my parents are immigrants, and so I think that gives me a different take on language than most people growing up kind of in a, you know, homogenous kind of neighborhood, because my parents spoke differently. So
did you work extra hard at trying
to
have some kind of
neutral
American non-accent?
Yeah, absolutely. And then and the thing that's really interesting to me is that the person who's studying this at the University of Washington, her name is Alicia Wasink. She's black, and she's the daughter of a Jamaican immigrant. And she is now, the original research that she did on this accent was of Anglo-white,
right.
Long-time residents, many generations here in the Northwest. So some of this stuff is an Anglo accent. But now what they're doing is they're expanding their research base. And so they're looking at African Americans, they're looking at Native Americans, they're looking at Hispanic Americans and Japanese Americans. And they're looking to see if these sort of Anglo ways of speaking are endemic to the rest of the population. In fact, they're finding they are, but there are differences as well. There are ethnic differences, and they're not really huge differences like there might be in Chicago or New York, where ethnic groups are really kind of entrenched. There's been a lot more kind of ethnic diversity and integration here, but they are finding, you know, I mean, that's what makes it so interesting, that there are differences and there are similarities as well.
Can I go to another word that's more of an affectation?
Sure.
Skip Knute Berger should be here to defend himself, because I had never heard this till I sat across from him many a time. Boing.
Oh, yeah. Boing, boing, boing.
I almost
said Boeing.
What happened to Boeing?
I know.
I don't know.
But you said that.
But I feel like he's from here, and so he must know that we're all wrong and that it's Boeing or whatever.
Oh, I thought you were going to put the S at the end.
Oh, there's that.
Because Washington natives put the S at the end.
Yeah. It's not Bartels, it's not Boeing's, but if you live here long enough, it is. No, it's Bartel.
Is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
See?
Crushing us a
okay.
week
It's
before
not Nordstrom's,
Christmas, man.
No, it's Nordstrom's, exactly.
Oh, that's right. It's not.
But back to accent, though. You mentioned Reddit. This blew up on Reddit. One of the posters said, I'm told I say measure with a Northwest accent by making it sound more like measure than measure. I'm completely with that. In fact, I built my brother's house with a bunch of, you know, construction workers. I volunteered on it, and they would talk. It was about, you know, you got to measure it out. The other thing was they also added an unnecessary preposition to everything. So it was like you trim it out and measure it out and trim it up and so ever since then, any time around the house, if it involves, I have to take out the tape measure to do something. Yeah. My wife has to hear, okay, so what you want to do is you want to take and you want to measure it out.
Well, so the thing, if you ask the linguists, there are a lot of things that people do that aren't necessarily part of the Pacific Northwest dialect. Some of them they call idiosyncratic. So there may be families that say weird things,
right,
that aren't necessarily, you know, said in the general population. But the other thing that they say is these little things that we do in the Pacific Northwest, they're not unique to the Pacific That's Northwest. Right. You can find them in other parts of the country, but we say them in a kind of unique combination of ways.
Well, how about from Spokane? Get a go, pitcher.
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 picture.
Yeah, now I'm listening to Anna King and hearing all sorts of different things. I mean, once you start listening for these things, you're going to hear them everywhere.
How
and
about
it'll drive you crazy?
How about both instead of both. Both? I say both, but there's a people
you're
put
adding
an L
L to both.
I hear other people say both. Bernard Ouellette. Looking at you, Bernard. I have a friend who swears that there's a Seattle accent that is kind of Canadian meets surfer. And
yes.
He gives, you've heard this? He gives the example of Dory Monson from Cairo Radio.
Yes.
Here's Dory talking about, for some reason he's talking about, like, should you use the bathroom if it has a shower in it? Anyway, here, listen to this.
So I put up this sign telling people who use this room to go to the bathroom that that's unacceptable. I'm very nice in the way I ask this.
And that's Dory Monson. It's a little bit, you know, have you heard Dory talk? It's sort of surferish, but we have, this friend of mine and I have an electrician in common who's also from Ballard, as Dory Monson is from Ballard. The dude talks exactly like Dory Monson, and I've never heard it anywhere else, but he comes over and it's a little Dory Monson.
Well, here's the funny thing. I talked to researchers in Oregon, and they say that in Oregon they've found the same Pacific Northwest traits that they've discovered here in Washington State, but they've also discovered a lot of California traits.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is, you know, Oregon is right midway between the two, and they've become the sort of linguistic melting pot. Dory, it's an interesting thing. Dory was a sports guy, right? So
yeah.
I don't know if it's a sports thing, too.
He's a sports guy that doesn't want to go downtown anymore.
Did you catch that? I remember that. Okay, we have no time constraints on KOW's Week in Review. This is how we do when we're just like letting it. We're not even going to measure this show because we're only online. What's that? We're not going to measure it out. What you want to do is exit you want to take and you want to measure it out. Shall we give the last word to the program community, which also has picked up on this?
Great. So much for bagels.
So much for what?
The bagels. You dropped them on the floor.
They're called bagels.
I lived in New York, Troy. I know what a bagel is.
What the hell is wrong with you?
What?
You say bagel wrong.
I say it the same as you.
Say it again.
Bagel. Can we just keep studying?
KUNW's Week in Review. Can we just keep going?
What was that?
That was the show community, the TV, the comedy community.
Oh, I don't know.
Talking bagels. We'll be right back. Are we even going to take a break? Should we do that again? You know what we're listening to? Who knows what we're listening to? Deborah Wong has her hand up.
Cereal.
This is Cereal. Have you listened? Are you listening to Cereal, the podcast?
I was not listening to Cereal, the podcast, but I knew we were going to talk about it today.
Uh-huh.
So I did. I last night. I like. What is that called when you do a when you just like sit
binge?
I binged listen last night.
Did you?
But then I realized you cannot binge listen to like 8 hours of audio.
What about books on tape?
Listen, if you don't know, this is. This podcast, Serial, has now replaced This American Life as the most downloaded podcast on iTunes. 3 million per episode. It just ended this week, 12 episodes of a serialized nonfiction crime drama. Essex Porter, did you listen to Serial?
I only heard of it this week, so that tells you how out of touch I am.
Joni Balton?
I am so with Essex on this.
Okay.
Just no.
Well, you know, we really didn't promote it on KUOW. I mean, it's a production of This American Life, but I can understand. It's like if you know it, you have been obsessed by it for months, and if you don't, you just don't.
Well, and it's really hard to catch up on because you go to the website and there's all these disclaimers that say these podcasts are meant to be listened to in order. If you have arrived at this page, go back to the beginning. They will not let you.
Oh, come on!
Like, go, you know, catch up in the middle. You've got to go. So I had.
And we think North Korea is a
problem. Episode
one. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, can we find somebody who has listened to this podcast? Because I haven't, and I'm going to tell you why in a moment, and we're going to find out if we actually found out who done it. But what's the who done it? KUOW's social media producer, Bond Huberman. You're a Serial listener, right?
I am a Serial listener. I love the show.
Love it. Like, I mean, I hear people talk worshipful of this show.
Did you say worship?
They worshipped this show. So give it, for those who don't know, I don't want to exclude anybody. What, you know, catch us up. This podcast is about what? And it's not funny.
So Sarah Koenig, the producer and host of the show, essentially takes us back through this true crime story that occurred in 1999, in which the suspect or the convicted character Adnan is sentenced to life in jail after murdering his ex-girlfriend, Haman Lee.
Right. So the question is, and we were told, this is journalism. This reporter is sort of reinvestigating the case in real time, right? She's interviewing people. She talks extensively to the accused and many other people. And then as people hear this, as the world hears it, then we weigh in and people give her tips, and she's sort of investigating it as we're listening.
Right. I mean, she's digging in. I mean, she is an experienced reporter, but she's sort of digging in almost like an intern law student, you know, starting mm-hmm. from the ground up with the case, going through all of the old records, re-interviewing all of the people who will speak to her that were, you know, a part of the trial and investigation. And bit by bit, she constructs the fact that this case remains a mystery, really.
Well, that's it. Okay, so here are my two objections, and I need you to tell me why I'm wrong. The reason why I have a 10-foot pole, and I did not touch cereal with it, and here's why. Because, first of all, when you a fictional whodunit, it really doesn't matter who done it because nobody did it because it's fiction. The author is creating a world and bringing you into it very, very deliberately to make you think something, to make you feel something. To go back and reinvestigate, lots of cases are murky, right? Unless there was a camera rolling. But when I'm told that she's going to interview someone who's accused and would love to get out of jail, the thing about fiction is it may be mysterious, but you understand why everybody in that fictional story is doing what they're doing. If you come out of a movie and say, why did the main character do that? That's called a bad movie. But she's going to interview the whole idea that who knows whether this guy's telling the truth. Yeah, you don't know. You don't know whether he's telling the truth or the DA or the defender or any of the other witnesses. And I just saw inconclusive coming down the pike. And what didn't it turn out to be inconclusive?
Absolutely. Which is kind of a spoiler, but not.
Right. It came out yesterday. So my question is, did you after, because I watched Lost and felt a little disappointed afterward, right? So did you after she concludes basically, well, you know, who knows whether this guy did it or not, did you feel like all those hours, 10 hours of your time, whatever, 8 hours was worth it?
Absolutely. I didn't feel disappointed by the ambiguousness of the ending whatsoever. I think the relationship you develop with the story as you go is not unlike the relationship you would have watching Law and Order. You know, you're really connected with how the central character, the investigator, moves through the story. And in this case, she's just, you know, having us look at how the justice system works or doesn't work in some cases. That's really the story for me.
Okay, so here's my part two of my objection, and then I'll turn it over to you guys. But this is not Law and Order in an important sense that a woman was killed. A woman was murdered, and I find it a little distasteful that so many people are all abuzz while they, you know, eat your cupcakes and go to your knitting class and drive around and, you know, like who done it, except you don't know who done it. You don't know that this reporter is giving you, you know, she didn't get much access to the family, as far as I know, of this murdered woman who has lost a real person. And then you combine that with the kind of yuck that there is about it. I keep hearing these internet memes. Isn't it crazy? Somebody said male Kemp on the show, on the ad on the show. And that person's probably an immigrant. That's hilarious. And somebody else said what was the big thing? There's a sale at the shrimp shack or something. And oh, well, let's all remix that. It just seems out of scale to what actually happened And because, of course it is, because you don't have anything else to go on. It's not a tightly written drama. It's just like a bunch of speculation, and isn't it fun?
Well, I would agree with you. That's my, perhaps my one quibble with the podcast, that Haman Lee as a character certainly fades into the background.
Right.
And we do start to miss her after a while. But, however, the fact that this journalist is taking time to give attention to this case, where perhaps attention wasn't paid in the first place by the people whose job it is to thoroughly investigate it, I think, you know, pays that victim an honor.
Hmm. Okay.
I listened to a few of the episodes yesterday. It seemed like there were a lot of questions raised about, I mean, there was like a corroborating witness for the guy who ends up being put away for life. And that witness who says that she spoke to him, like, at the time, the exact time that the crime was taking place, was never interviewed, was never put on the stand.
Why not?
I don't know. Was that ever...
They're not sure why. The defending attorney is now deceased, and we can't find
and
out why.
And the defending attorney was also disbarred for... for some sort of fraud, not related to this case, but related to something else. And so there was maybe this speculation that she wanted to make more money from this family because there could have been there wasn't going to be an appeal. And it was all this really strange circumstances. And
so then if it's investigative journalism, tell me something is going to come out of this. There's going to be an investigation. The system, that is going to be changed in some way.
Well, in fact, Sarah Koenig spoke to an attorney with the Innocence Project, and now that team is investigating the case and looking into DNA samples.
Okay. That's good. It was that good. I mean, I heard it was fantastic. I didn't listen. I'm bringing you on to it so we can jaw it out. I'm not saying anybody who listened is awful, especially Bond Huberman, but it's been an interesting relationship as I've not listened, but listened to other people talk about it all this way.
You also have to separate what the aim of the producers was and how the internet took it and what social media did with it or whatever. That's a whole separate thing.
Yes.
And she says, through and through, she was trying to be extremely respectful. She, as she was reporting this, she knew what was at stake, and that was always top of mind for her.
Yep.
So. And how the world responds to it is an entirely different matter.
Yes. And finally, the last thought is how the world responds to this. I do think it's truly going to be interesting because the way people are talking about this, it's like this is a watershed in investigative, sort of episodic, serialized journalism. Look how many people got pulled into this. And as you said, maybe some actual positive change will come out of the fact that somebody figured out a way to hook people with audio.
Totally.
I mean, because video, you can only do so much, if you don't have the visuals, right? But yeah. To tell you a story, that's essentially human, is that you tell a story and listen to a story, and that it and it's that popular, something you can do while you're driving and folding the clothes.
I think this is great news for all of us in radio, because even though this was a podcast, it's oral storytelling. It's mm-hmm. it's something that people looked forward to. It's people talking, and that's good for us. I mean, if there is a business model that rises up out of this,
But I hope the business model is we get to reinvestigate true crime stories. Right. It just seems mm-hmm. to me I would like to see if there's going to be a great model for oral storytelling, I would like it to be on something of greater and broader significance than an individual murder case.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, but if you have a template, you can broaden it.
Well, I have a feeling that the reason it's interesting is because it's a murder case,
yeah.
Not just because it's really great oral storytelling.
Yeah.
Well, Bond, thank you for filling us in.
Absolutely.
That was one of the big stories this week, the questionable conclusion, and we'll see where it goes, of the Serial podcast. Rolling on, Week in Review with KUOW's Deborah Wong, Cairo TV's Essex Porter, Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke. This week, isn't it today that the testing is just starting on these at least the training of some Seattle police department officers on body cameras? And Essex, you've reported on this.
Right. One of the things in my reporting that I've tried to explore is Over the years, there's been a clamor for video of police in action. Started with dash cameras. Seattle police have dashboard cameras. We saw the episode in Ferguson, Missouri this summer. That led to even more pressure nationally and certainly more pressure here for police to wear body cameras. And that is something that City Council Member Bruce Harrell has been pushing for a couple of years. Now we have a new police chief. She has a new chief operating officer, and they are today beginning the training for the use of body cameras for police. But the question I've always had is, how much of a difference is it going to make? If you actually look at some of the body cam video that's already online, you can see things are happening with police officers, and you still can't necessarily tell what provoked an officer to do a particular thing.
Well, but one of the selling points of this, and President Obama is in big on this, he's called for 50,000 body cameras on police. The idea, of course, is that you change the behavior of the police officer and you at least document when these events of unreasonable force or just unreasonable policing occur. So the idea is when everybody's on a camera, they behave differently. I was stopped for speeding, if one could
except
imagine.
For Rob Ford.
Yes, of course.
He's the only
person. He gets better on the camera. I understand what you mean. But I was stopped once for speeding on Blewett Pass. I know that's hard to believe. But the officer, as he pulled me over, said, "You're on a camera." I never said this because, you know, my mom and the manners and the whole thing. But I was thinking, what do you think? I'm going to act differently because I'm on a camera? But he thought it was important to tell me that some camera that was staring at this whole interaction.
Well, Essex, why do you say you can't tell what provoked a police officer if the whole thing is being recorded?
Well, because the reason I say that is it's just like when you are, you know, doing your home movies at the holidays. Your camera may be not quite pointed in the proper direction as your body turns. Your camera may not see everything. There's a video online where a pair of police officers ultimately decides to use a taser on a suspect. And when you look at that video, the police officer is wearing the body camera on his chest. He is holding the taser out, just straight out from the chest. And actually, his arms and the weapon itself block what provoked the officer, what the suspect did to provoke the officer to actually go ahead and tase him.
We need GoPro on the head where your arms are not in front of you.
So, one of the things actually Seattle police are doing, they are testing a chest camera, but they are also testing sort of an eyeglass camera.
Oh, yeah.
So, which may help avoid some
might
of that.
Help.
I just, what I've tried to do in my reporting is just raise the question of, you know, is it the panacea? And Mike Wagers, the chief operating officer of Seattle Police, has told me on camera, we've put it on the air, it is not the panacea. It is another tool. You know, the camera can fall off when the officer is running. You know, but it is another tool. One of the things that everyone does seem to agree on is what Joni has talked about is behavior changes. Even if the camera's not capturing everything, behavior of both the officer and the civilian changes because the camera is there.
Well, one of the reasons to absolutely do this, at least try it with the 12 officers, is because everyone is videotaping everything. So the police, if they're not taping, they're the only one that didn't do the taping.
Right. That's another thing police are saying. That's right.
Did you get a sense of how rank and file police officers feel about this? I mean, do they find it intrusive or?
The sense is, yeah, you know, it's you know, sort of split. It's really, you know, they have a lot to do. They had a lot of technology to manage. Some of it is just, gosh, another piece of technology to manage. If I forget something, someone's going to be suspicious that I didn't turn it on purpose. And maybe, you know, something happened. I tried to go help right away, and I didn't think to turn it on. There are a number of officers who are feeling like, just as Joni said, you know, everybody else is recording it. We might as well have our own
version of it.
Our own version. One of the big challenges, I mean, we've been talking about how it affects officers and civilians. One of the big challenges is Washington has a pretty expansive public disclosure law, and now departments are going to be getting, you know, terabytes of video to manage. Some things do have to be redacted. How do you redact all this video and have a timely response to a public disclosure request? And very interesting what a computer software developer in Burien has been doing in terms of making requests, not so much to inundate police departments with requests, but to get them to think about how they are going to manage this video.
And the redacted is important because, you know, imagine police are going into people's homes and recording people, and there's kids that get recorded. There's all kinds of, you know, people being captured in situations where they don't want to be.
I mean, police meet
posted on YouTube.
Police meet you on the worst day of your life.
There you go.
And it's being recorded.
And apparently, there's a hackathon going on today,
yep.
Right? That the police have invited tech folks to come in and try to help them solve this problem.
Right. There is software that could perhaps automatically find the face and fuzz out the face, and that's or automatically strip the audio. So that's what they're doing at the police department as we record this.
Mm-hmm.
There is a hackathon with software developers who are invited.
Because as we know, technology can solve all problems. It makes the world completely better.
Well, that isn't
right?
True.
Sony Pictures?
That isn't true. Yeah. But Mayor Ed Murray has made technology kind of a key thing. He wants to use data in a sort of new modern way, and he wants to have the public have access. But as you just pointed out, once you have all that data, the storing, the redacting, the people filing, there was one public disclosure request that they figured would take like a zillion years to fill. You're solving some problems and you're bringing on some new ones.
Time for one last topic because we're in overtime. We're in bonus time at this point, and I got to go see my kids' like Christmas preschool show thing. So can you talk to me, please, Deborah Wong, about elephants?
Oh, okay. Well,
what's the update? You reported on elephants this week.
Yeah, so there's not too much to update other than we know that the two elephants at the Woodland Park Zoo will be going away. The zoo is looking for a new home for them. They want to send them to another zoo. They just think that two elephants is lonely, and they want a bigger herd for them. In the meantime, people who are critical of the zoo say, no, you shouldn't send them to another zoo. You should send them to a wildlife sanctuary, and they've been keeping up the pressure. I mean, this has been a campaign that's been going on for years. The new thing is, I think that the public opinion and the political establishment, the media establishment, I mean, the Seattle Times has been editorializing about this. The mayor has come out and said sanctuary. Several city council members have been saying sanctuary. There's been a lot going on behind the scenes, a lot of pressure that's being put on the zoo board by our political establishment to get them to send these elephants to sanctuary. But it doesn't seem like that's in the cards, at least today. I mean, this week when I talked to the folks at the zoo, they say they've got 3 to 5 good options of zoos that might be good fits for these elephants. So it seems like they're going their way. They do not believe philosophically in the idea of sanctuary. They want their elephants, you know, on exhibit to continue to educate the public. So I think that, you know, my sense is that lots of folks are going to be very disappointed when they end up going to another zoo. That's my sense.
And may I just say that the zoo officials stepped into a certain amount of zoo do, if that's the right term, because of the way they have handled this with the public process and the press. There must be a lesson here somewhere for how you engage your public and your viewing public.
Yeah, they kicked reporters out saying they didn't have enough room. See, reporters, they need a larger enclosure for the for reporters.
And a big herd.
We are a social, we are used to traveling in packs. And if we get restricted, then we start to exhibit, you know, behavior like, you know, we start to kind of wave back and forth and ask the same question over and over again. That's stressed behavior.
Yes, and peanuts alone won't fix that.
Will not fix it. And finally, the folks who want to send these elephants to a sanctuary, they went Christmas caroling this week on Monday at City Hall, rewording Christmas carols for Chai and Bamboo. Now, I suggested a few titles on this show. Please Don't Let It Snow, I'm From a Warm Climate, Keep Me Away from a Manger, There's a Baby in There, All Drummer Boys Are Little to Me, and Grandma is Lucky She Only Got Run Over by a Reindeer. These are all elephant carols. I put it on Facebook, And, of course, my Facebook friends did so much better. I'm dreaming of a white elephant. I'll have a poo Christmas. Have a holly jolly life in servitude. Santa Claus is coming to town, or so we've heard. It really doesn't mean anything to us, seeing as how we are elephants. It's beginning to look a lot like rapidly dwindling habitat. And I saw Mommy artificially inseminating Santa Claus.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry to leave you that last image.
No, you're not.
Not really. This has been KOW's Week in Review. We're in bonus time. We got knocked off the air by President Obama, who sometimes acts like who made you president? You know what I mean? Oh, wait a minute. We did. So he kicked us off the air with his news conference. And so we've been on the air for, what, like an extra 10 minutes. So if you want to give a little something back, you know, you can pledge to KOW. What did those 10 minutes mean to you? I just said artificially inseminating Santa Claus. What's that
That's
worth
like
to you?
That's the worst thing you've said.
Make your pledge. Hey, thank you, everybody. Essex Porter from Cairo TV. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
For an hour and 10 minutes.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays to you. Deborah Wong, KUOW News, and In Close on KCTS 9. Great to talk with you.
Thanks, Bill.
Joni Balter, all throughout the year, it's been great to talk with
and
you.
And with you as well.
Seattle
Happy
Channel. Happy holidays to you. And Bon Huberman, speaking, I think the next big podcast after Serial is going to be KUOW's Week in Review. How can people, remind us, how can people hear us and interact with us and everything online?
They should just go straight to KOW.org.
That's it?
That's it.
And they'll find out about the tweets and the Facebooks and the podcasts?
That's right. It's all there.
Okay. It's the age of the podcast. 2015 is going to be our year on the Week in Review. Happy holidays again, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Jason Pagano produces this show, except when he's out sick, in which case it's Andy Hurst. And Ann Kane, thanks for all the work. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you real soon.